Matthew chapter 22, starting at verse 23. That same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him with a question. Teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and have children for him. Now there are seven brothers among us. The first one married and died, and since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second and third brother, right on down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be of the seven, since all of them were married to her? Jesus replied, You are in error, because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching.
Father, please help us to listen now to your word. Would it change our hearts and change our lives? Amen. Now, when it comes to politics, you can't get much more exciting than a presidential debate. Two candidates for the presidency slugging it out in front of millions to convince voters that they're the ones to go for. And the consequences are huge, aren't it? One slip of the tongue can mean the end. You spend millions on the presidential campaign. But if you mess up, you can go from being the person who could have been the most influential person in the world to a historical footnote. Well, today's passage, it's another intense debate. It's round two. It's the religious establishment against Jesus the upstart, who's ridden into town on a donkey. He's making all kinds of claims for kingship. He's not afraid to challenge the status quo, and he's not afraid to tell the religious establishment where they're getting it wrong. And the polling figures are not looking good for the religious leaders. Jesus is up and they're down. So, of course, they come out fighting. And they set up a series of encounters, trying their best to undermine Jesus and destroy his credibility. It's all very well launching a leadership campaign, Jesus, but where's your policy? What are your views on the hot topics? Now, you know what they say, there are two certainties in life. There's death and taxes. Last week was taxes. This week, it's death, okay? Or life after death. And that's a big question, isn't it? It's a big question, life after death. We're still asking it today. It's probably not something we actually really want to think about, you know, if we're honest. No one really wants to think about death, but it's something we should think about, or at least have a view on. And if people say they don't have a view on death, well, they probably live as if they do have a view on it. And Jesus' response to today's challenge about life after death is so astonishing and has so much authority that it leaves the Sadducees silent. His critics with no comeback. Have a look down, verses 33 and 34. When the crowd heard this, that's Jesus' response, they were astonished at the teaching. And then carrying on, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, silenced. When was the last time you saw a political debate where one of the debaters was silenced? No comeback. Well, you never see that, because no answer equals no authority. You know, if you can't answer a question in a big debate, you might as well not turn up. You would have been better having not even turned up. Sadducees have no comeback. It's the equivalent of a political knockout, isn't it? That's why the Sadducees are just a historical footnote, and Jesus Christ is a heavyweight. Now, before we dive into today's passage, here's a question. How confident are you in your belief about what happens when you die? And who is your authority on the issue? Because it's going to happen to all of us. So you better be sure that your authority is a heavyweight, not a historical footnote. So there are two things I want to draw out from today's passage and what Jesus tells us about life after death. The first one is an answer, and the second one is an assurance. An answer to the question, is there life after death? And an assurance that should give us confidence when the doubts set in. So first, an answer. And the writer of this account, Matthew, he makes it very clear, verse 23, have a look down, verse 23, what's at stake in the encounter. And he also tells us everything we need to know about the Sadducees. Verse 23, that same day the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him. These were highly respected religious leaders. They believed in God, but they didn't believe in life after death. They thought that once the lights went out, that was it. No soul, no afterlife, nothing. This life is all there is. And they would have agreed with Richard Dawkins wholeheartedly, who said, don't kid yourself that you're going to live again after you die. You're not. They would have agreed with that. And because it's a defining issue for them, they come to Jesus because they want his comment. Verse 24, teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and have children for him. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died. And since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second and third brother, right on down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now, there was a kind of cultural tradition in those times that if a man married a woman and then he died, if he had a brother, the brother would marry her and try to give her children. And it was kind of a way of looking after her and providing for her and giving her security. But what the Sadducees do is they just take it to an extreme. What happens, they say, if there are seven brothers? So we'll call her Gertrude. Brother number one marries Gertrude, but then number one dies, so number two marries Gertrude. He dies, so number three marries her, and so on. Until poor old Gertrude, she's married seven brothers before she dies. And verse 28, here's the question they put to Jesus. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be of the seven? Since all seven were married to her. And I want to, can you kind of sense the just how much they are ridiculing the idea of the resurrection and trying to trip Jesus up? Because either way, he says, yes, you're right. The idea of life after death is ridiculous. And he does that, and he automatically alienates the majority of the crowd who kind of believe in some kind of resurrection. Or he says, no, there is a resurrection, in which case he's dealing with Gertrude and her seven husbands, and he's just looking like an idiot. So the question asked, the Sadducees kind of stand back, and wait for Jesus' response. And you can almost sense the smirk on their face. How is he going to play it? Well, he says, verse 29, Jesus replied, you're in error because you don't know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. Jesus recognized, he knows what's at stake here. This isn't about Gertrude. This is about the resurrection and whether there's life after death. So he doesn't mince his words. You're wrong. And having made clear that they're wrong about the resurrection, he goes on to deal with their kind of twisted little conundrum. So verse 30, he says, at the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. Now, the problem with their little story about Gertrude is they made the mistake of assuming that the next life would be the same as this one. that because people marry in this life, okay, that they're going to be marrying in the next life. That's the mistake they made. Now, Fran and Noah and I, we went on holiday to France a short while back. We came back last week, and the night before we were due to fly back, we had a really bad night's sleep for a number of reasons. And so when we got back home, you know, we were knackered, really tired. And I remember putting Noah down to sleep the night we got home, thinking, he's tired, we're tired, this is brilliant, he's going to sleep so well, and a really good night's sleep. Okay, so 2 a.m., 5 a.m., it turns out it's wrong to assume a tired baby will sleep well. And the point is this is the point. Bad assumptions lead to poor predictions. Okay, bad assumptions lead to poor predictions. That was my problem. That was the Sadducees' problem. But why had they got things so wrong about their view of life after death? What had they got wrong? Jesus is very clear, verse 29. You do not know the scriptures or the power of God. You guys have got it wrong because you don't understand the scriptures that they do teach about the resurrection. And more importantly, you've totally misunderstood God's power. He's God. Of course he's got power to raise the dead to life. And not only does he have the power to raise the dead to life, but you've misunderstood what the resurrection life might even look like. It's not business as usual. The resurrection life isn't going to sort of pick up where things carried on. And he applies it to the issue of marriage. And to this conundrum about Gertrude, okay? And in the resurrection life, Jesus tells us there is going to be no marriage. Marriage is reserved for this life only, and it's temporary. And for some here, that's going to be kind of hard to hear. Marriage might have brought you so much joy and intimacy and security that to hear that there's not going to be marriage in heaven, how's that good news? But look carefully at what Jesus is saying. He says marriage is going to be inappropriate in heaven, not love. And whilst he doesn't go on to elaborate, I think what he's trying to say here is that heavenly relationships are going to go beyond marriage. They're not going to be less than marriage. Heavenly relationships are going to be more than marriage. It's not like our love is going to be diluted. No. Our love is just going to kind of grow. So we've only got Noah at the moment, and obviously I love him as a father. But I like to think that if we have other children, if another one arrives, my love for Noah is not going to halve the moment a second child arrives. No, not at all. More children, more love. And that's exactly what it's going to be like in heaven. More relationships, more love. And love feeds off love. It's good to be reminded that marriage is temporary. But we rightly hold marriage up as a really important institution. Of course it is. But there's got to be a temptation, hasn't there, for those who are kind of single amongst us and maybe want to be married, to look around at the married couples and kind of think, oh man, marriage is just the most amazing thing ever. And just to idolize it in a really unhealthy way. It's only temporary, and we shouldn't attach greater importance to it than we need to. Or turning it the other way around, for married couples, there's got to be a temptation when married life is going really well, which is a wonderful blessing, to just invest all your time and money and emotional energy in something which is temporary, to make an idol of that relationship. I wonder if you've seen, there's a Land Rover Defender advert which has got the strap line, which is like one life, live it. And it just massively appeals to guys because it's like a Land Rover halfway up a mountain covered in snow. And I just look at it and think, oh, I want to quit my job and go and drive up mountains. But the strap line is so good, one life, live it. In other words, there's only one life. So make the most of it now, you know. Make the most of it now. Quit your job. Get rid of responsibilities. I don't know. That you read into what you want. But if the Sadducees had a bumper sticker, that would probably be it. One life. Live it. And I think many of us here have got to admit we can be similar to the Sadducees, investing our money, time, and energy as if there was only one life and we're trying to live it now. So let me give you an example where I'm tempted to live like a Sadducee, as if life is all there is. Travel. So I've got a globe on my desk where I was writing this talk, and it may be a sign of how distractible I am, but when I was meant to be writing it, I would sort of glance up and got the Pacific Ocean kind of facing me, and I'd say, there's so many random islands in the Pacific Ocean. And I'd be like, oh, well, I wonder what that island's like. And I'd stop my talk and then just Google search it for images. And I'd kind of have TripAdvisor in my mind, just rating the beaches and going, that looks amazing. I'd love to go on holiday there. Well, those mountains look brilliant. My problem is too many beautiful places to visit, not enough time. The truth is, I don't need to see them all in this life. I've got eternity to visit the most beautiful places and interesting cultures. And they're going to be all the more wonderful because they won't be tarnished by the degradation of this world. So when my colleagues jet off to Bali, I don't need to be jealous because I'm not going to miss out. I should say, when I was giving this talk this morning, Ashley Down, turned out there was someone leaving for Bali tomorrow. And I think I made them feel a bit guilty. It's nothing to do with Bali. I do want to go there, though. But what about you, okay? What is it which, if I said to you, not in this life, you'd be crushed? How would you feel if you worked your whole career without ever becoming influential? But in heaven, you'll be seated at God's right hand and you'll be reigning with King Jesus. What if you will never earn enough to live comfortably? But in heaven, there will be riches, overflowing riches. You'll never have to check your bank account. You'll never have to worry about scrimping and saving. What if you're always going to be struggling with your health in this life? Yeah, but in heaven, there'll be no more crying or tears or pain or death. Here's an excerpt from a Puritan prayer that sums up what we can look forward to in the next life. O Lord, I live here as a fish in a vessel of water, only enough to keep me alive, but in heaven, I shall swim in the ocean. Here I have a little air in me to keep me breathing, but there I shall have sweet and fresh gales. Here I have a beam of sun to lighten my darkness, a warm ray to keep me from freezing. Yonder I shall live in light and warmth forever. So that's the answer Jesus gave to the Sadducees. There is a resurrection. It'll be wonderful. And we should live now with that truth in mind. But as well as being an answer, there's also an assurance of resurrection, which is my second point. Verse 31, have a look down, will you? But about the resurrection of the dead, haven't you read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, to prove to the Sadducees that he's talking with authority about the fact that there is life after death, Jesus refers back to the book of Exodus, where God reveals himself to Moses for the first time. Okay, and if you're sitting here thinking, how does that quote at all help give us any assurance about the resurrection? Okay, you're in good company. That was me this time last week. So how does that quote help? How does it give you any assurance? How does it say anything about the resurrection? Well, when Jesus uses that phrase, he's wanting us to think back to some very specific promises God made to Abraham in the early Bible history. So Genesis 17, God promises Abraham, he says, I am going to bless you, and I'm going to bless your children. And it's not just any kind of promise God's making. It's what we call a covenant, which is, it's kind of like a binding contract. And the closest we have would be marriage vows, which bind a husband and wife together. And this is what God says to Moses in Genesis 17. He says, I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for generations to come. Now, when God says everlasting, okay, he's not just saying for a really long time in the same way that I might say, yeah, the train journey home, took forever. Okay, he's not speaking like that. When he says everlasting, he means everlasting, literally. And his promise to bless his people, it cannot be stopped or defeated. And it can't be defeated because death isn't the end. There is life and blessing beyond death for those who trust in the Lord. That's why when God speaks to Moses in Exodus, he says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am. Now, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they'd been dead for hundreds of years at the point God speaks to Moses. But God says, I am their God. Not I was their God. I am their God. And as believers, we're part of that same covenant. We're drawn into the family. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we're in it with them. And just as death wasn't the end for them, so it's not the end for us. God's blessings to us are unending. The Jesus storybook puts it this way. God loves us with a never-stopping, never-giving-up, unbreaking, always-and-forever love. Always-and-forever love. And the Apostle Paul, he got this. Romans 8, this is what he said. Amazing. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God. Isn't that amazing? That's an amazing assurance. It's wonderful, isn't it? Because let's be honest, death is quite scary. You know, the world just spends its time saying to us, you can never move beyond death. But God's promises punch through death. And it's also wonderful to be reminded that the hope of eternity with God is based on his promise, not our performance. See, you might have had a bad week, but his promise is the same this Sunday as it was last Sunday. So in response to the Sadducees' question, there's an answer and there's an assurance. There is a resurrection. We can have amazing assurance that it will happen. And the reaction Jesus gets, we've looked at them, verse 33, 34. The crowd are astonished. The Sadducees are silenced. See, they come hoping to just wipe the floor with Jesus. And basically, they just kind of have to troop off really sheepishly, just really embarrassing for them. But here's the thing. If you're skeptical, you may have been listening to Jesus' teaching thinking, okay, yeah, I mean, it's obviously very impressive, but why should I listen to him rather than anyone else, rather than my friends at school or colleagues at work, rather than the media? Very good question. Within a few hours of this kind of showdown, Jesus is arrested and crucified and killed. And if that's where things had stayed, you can be sure no one would be talking about Jesus' words today. You know, as impressive as they are, he would have just been another footnote, wouldn't he? Just like the Sadducees. Of course, he didn't stay dead. I wonder, can you remember back to 2008, the Beijing Olympics? It was a 100-meter final. And there'd been a lot of talk about Usain Bolt, you know. What was he going to do? People thought something special. And he was definitely talking the talk. But would he deliver? And the gun goes off, and he gets a terrible start. And 40 meters in, you're thinking, you know, failure. And then his kind of stride starts lengthening out. And you're like, hello, something's happening here. And it just starts lengthening. It just starts accelerating away from people. And you think, well, these guys running through treacle or something. It was like embarrassing how slow he was making them look. And he gets to 70 meters, and he turns around. And, you know, where is everyone? And everyone's thinking, what's going on? And his arms stretched out, and he kind of coasts across the line. Because it's all so happening so quickly, you're thinking, okay, well, you know, it's a good race, but can't possibly have been slow. And he's 9.69 seconds. And you're just like, how on earth Has someone smashed the world record while seemingly cruising across the finishing line? You know, he talked the talk, but when he crossed the line, you're like, you're the king. You are the king when it comes to running. Jesus Christ, when he rose again, he rose as king over life and death. So when he speaks about the resurrection, we listen. Usain Bolt's record was awesome, but it won't be long before someone does exactly the same thing again. That's not going to happen with Jesus. His resurrection is a sign of what awaits those who trust in him, an eternal life with God, blessings which cannot be defeated. And as Jesus puts it to the Sadducees, that's because he is the God, he is not the God of the dead, he's the God of the living. Let's pray. There's some words from the from what's called the Nicene Creed, which say, I look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. Father, please, please help us to live lives that reflect where we're going. And in the face of doubt and fear and uncertainty, please give us confidence, not in ourselves, not in our performance, but in the great King who triumphed over death on the cross to purchase our future. Amen.
Thanks very much, Ian, for helping us get our heads around that. Here's quite a tough question to start off with. Someone says, this heaven that you talk of, it sounds so good, it makes the thought of suicide tempting. What is God's view on that?
Wow. That's not one I prepared for.
It's a huge topic. Give us a kind of, can you give us a headline, a couple of bullet points?
God creates us and is the creator and sustainer of our lives. And we come into being because of him. And it's not for us to decide when our lives should end. As the creator, that's his prerogative to decide. So I would come down on the line of the fact that I think that would be wrong, biblically, suicide. But it's an enormously tricky issue. And there are all kinds of reasons why someone might actually feel like that's the only option. If this sort of thing is at all an issue, then the right thing to do is come to talk to one of the elders about it. Framing it in the context of the question, yeah, heaven is going to be wonderful, but it is the Lord's prerogative to decide when he will call us back.
Like Ian said, much more to say, do come and grab Ian, myself, or someone who came with, if that's something you want to talk about more, please do. I was just thinking about where Paul is grappling with it, not quite the same thing, but in the letter to the Philippians, he's talking about he's looking forward to heaven, and he knows it's going to be great, and he recognises this. He says, I desire to depart, doesn't he, and be with the Lord. So he recognises there's something good there beyond the grave. But interestingly, he comes down on kind of, but actually I'll stay because there's work to be done now, in the here and now, this side of glory, for the Philippians' benefit and for other believers and non-believers. He wants to throw himself into the gospel work that's urgently needed to be done now. I guess a bit like you were saying about yourself earlier. So maybe that's one other kind of bit of the Bible that speaks into that.
Yeah, I mean, you could turn it around and say, well, you know, you've seen how wonderful heaven is, but there are so many people who don't know that. And why not spend the rest of your days trying to tell others how great it is.
A couple of other kind of slightly more just kind of questions about the passage and what's going on here. Someone says, verse 32.
Mm-hmm.
Question is, why is he not the God of the dead? And then, I don't know if this is connected, similar question, is this physical or spiritual dead? Does that make sense to your question?
Yeah, I think so. I think what that verse is trying to emphasize, verse 32, is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. The point Jesus is trying to make here is that those who trust and believe in him are alive with him. He's not so much making a comment on the point of death and who's dead and who's not and whether you're physically dead or spiritually dead. No, this is him saying, look, if you're in his covenant, you are alive. Death is not the end. And in a very real sense, though we all physically die, yet as believers we are still alive. Luke talks a little bit about this in the sense that Jesus on the cross with the criminals, and one of the criminals basically says, look, I've got life wrong, you know, remember me when you die. And Jesus says, today you will be with me in paradise. In other words, here he is again speaking about the future and saying, yeah, you're gonna die. But, I mean, today, I mean, how exciting is that? Today, within 24 hours, it's nuts. This is amazing, these promises. You're going to be with me in paradise. You'll be alive. Now, whether that is going to be physical resurrection at that point, or whether physical resurrection will happen when Jesus comes again and establishes a new creation, that's a sort of a separate issue. But there is life after death. Whether that's physical life, as we know it now, immediately after our death, whether that will happen later is a separate issue.
Another question is connected with this question of, I guess, physicality of new creation, of heaven. Mm. One question says, how do we know there will be islands to visit in heaven, for example, et cetera, it says. Surely, if the Sadducees were wrong to assume this thing about marriage, we could be wrong to assume there'll be islands to visit. I guess there's a bigger question there about do we really know what heaven will be like? How do we know?
Yeah, I suppose I was just trying to draw out a point when I did that. I'm hoping there will be, but you know there may not be. There's actually a good deal of speculation about exactly what heaven will look like. The Bible tells us what we need to know, which is really the resurrection life. It's not about where we are or who we are or who we're with. It's about who we're worshipping. And it's all about worshipping Jesus Christ and being with him. But we're also told it's going to be a new creation, and it's going to be a physical creation. It's not going to be like the Philadelphia advert when you're kind of floating on the clouds. It will be very real and very tangible. And no one looks forward to floating on a cloud. Very real and very tangible. And so it's important to hold on to that there will be a physical creation. But everything will be orientated around worshipping the Lord.
One last question for us, for you. We want to go on thinking about these things, talking about these things, applying these things into our lives. We're going to do that in small groups later and in the week. Can you give us a kind of a top tip, how to make the best of our time in small group? What's a kind of key question for us to be discussing together?
If the outside world looked in, would they be able to tell that we, as a group or as individuals, that we are living for heaven, or that for us everything is this world? Mm. Something to discuss.
Great. Thank you. Thanks so much, Ian. And you'll be around here if anyone wants to come and grab you afterwards to talk more about any of those things.
Yeah.